Ecclesiastes 3 tells us that these are the worst of times and the best of times. Except it's not Ecclesiastes, right? It's Charles Dickens in A Tale of Two Cities. That line is so pertinent for our time. He writes, and I quote, "It was the best of times and it was the worst of times. It was the age of wisdom. It was the age of foolishness. It was the epic of belief. It was the epic of incredulity. It was a season of light. It was a season of darkness. It was a season of hope, and it was the winter of despair. We had everything before us. We had nothing before us. We were all going direct to heaven. We were all going direct the other way. In short, the period was so far like the present period that some of its noisiest authorities insisted on it being received, for good or for evil, in the superlative degree of comparison only." End quote. Ecclesiastes simply states that there's a time for absolutely everything. Don't you sort of wish with me that there was a little less time for some things? I can barely accept, I can't even do it, that the country of which I am a citizen, that we are separating immigrant children from their parents and keeping them in large dog cages. We do not even know if the children are being adequately cared for, and of course, they are not, because we are creating abandonment issues of gigantic proportions because we cannot create a make-sense immigration policy. We are creating the worst of times that will last for the kids' lifetimes. There are no best of times when we separate young children from their parents for lack of political will to do the right things. Our scripture lesson this morning is one of my personal favorites. I would understand if it's not yours. But as a guy who comes from a crazy-making, oftentimes cruel, chaotic family of origin, I gravitate to this one. The story, the narrative told, is about Jesus coming home to Nazareth near the beginning of his public ministry, the ministry that we know about, and he is declared by his mother and siblings as mentally unstable. Out of his mind is the term used, and he and his disciples are run out of town eventually. Serious students and professors of the Bible know this story, and a couple others in Mark's gospel, as the most credible stories we have about Jesus' family of origin. The most credible. Mark's gospel is the earliest one of the three gospels that purport to give us historical information about Jesus. Mark is on Jesus' side, and he has no reason to make up stories about Jesus' family of origin not being supportive. It is from Mark's gospel that we learn that Jesus has biological brothers and sisters. And in this earliest of histories, Jesus' hometown is Nazareth, not Bethlehem. Mark does not have any Jesus birth stories at all. In Mark's story, everything happens the old-fashioned way. And in it, Jesus has left home. He has abandoned his role, his responsibilities as the oldest son. And he comes home. And it appears as if his fame has not reached them yet. Because when confronted with Jesus' audacity to be critical of the religious system of his day, while religious authorities are present to hear him speaking, his family basically comes forward to try to protect him, to take him away from the crowds. But when they try to do so, Jesus rejects them and says, "These crowds, these people who follow in my way, who dare stand out and take risks for justice, they are my family now, not you that I grew up with." Ouch. world, at a time when family loyalty defined one's place in society, Jesus stood aside of that and declared that those who follow after the ways of God are a family that demands supreme loyalty. And in today's world of tribalism and its kissing cousin, nationalism and patriotism, we need to remember that Jesus offers us a look at where we are called to stand as women and men of faith. Now, I know too much history gets boring, to be sure, but we need to know enough to be truthful about our faith. It was another 10 to 20 years after Mark does his writing of the gospel according to Mark, before Matthew and Luke wrote the next two gospel narratives. Matthew and Luke plagiarized 80% of their material. They stole from Mark and brought over here. They do not give him credit once. They did not take any of the stories about Jesus' childhood, though, probably because they were sort of negative stories in Mark's gospel. And so they wrote their own birth narratives. The two birth stories in Matthew and Luke do not agree with each other, but they are so much more fun to repeat at Christmas than the real stories. And by the time, 30 years later, when the Gospel of John is written, way out here, Mary is elevated very highly. You might remember that she appears nearly immediately in John's story, not giving birth to Jesus, because in John's Gospel, Jesus has been with God since the beginning of time. But she is there, bossing Jesus at a wedding, telling him what miracle to perform, you know, water into wine. That she is in charge of her family, that she is a typical Jewish mother, one might argue, is surely culturally accurate, okay? Jesus, in this morning's narrative account, demonstrates a place that the church often finds its being, separate and apart from the demands of family structures and popular societal demands. Too often, as you know, the church has not stood outside of society, supporting those most in need, but rather has supported even to this day some of the most ugly societal demands. I remind you that First United Church, this congregation in the 50s, was the first church to openly integrate in Bloomington, inviting into membership black families. This church's pastor, the Reverend Doug Ray, led the movement in Bloomington, integrating lunch counters and so much more here in town. And a dozen black families became official members here until they promised to be here until they moved away from town or if they died. And they honored those commitments. And I did the last of that group's funerals when I moved here 12 years ago when John and Helen Drake died. Today, we would probably say it was backwards. A dozen of us probably should have joined predominantly black congregations, but I guess we learn as we go. And then in the late 1990s and early 2000s, this congregation became family to a growing number of gay and lesbians in Bloomington. Our congregation got booted out of Nazareth. We were kicked out of our association of churches in Indiana and Kentucky, as we openly embraced LGBTQ folks as equals, as normal, as one of all of us. We as one of them. And we remain ostracized to this day, as do most LGBTQ folks from families of origin, because we believe that in Jesus Christ, everyone is welcome, regardless of skin tones or sexual orientations or gender. Now, you and I both know that there has been a lot of really bad biblical interpretation on so many fronts through the centuries, and I probably do my share. I just don't know it, right? But we are living in the best of times because we get to correct our mistakes, mistakes that have cost people their lives. For the sake of truth, we need to learn how to stand up for the sake of people's lives. Up until 1946, there were no anti-homosexual references in the Bible. Put that in your brain for a little bit, okay? In 1946 is when the Revised Standard Bible that was produced and distributed as the most common language Bible available to humankind came out. And the number of those Bibles printed is in the high millions, if not billions or more. It was a mass production of Bible in unheard of numbers, and it produced and then reproduced the term homosexual in our scriptures for the first time in 2,000 years. It wasn't there before, and it has had strikingly negative consequences ever since. The Revised Standard Version of the Bible was written soon after the American Medical Association deemed homosexuality as a disease state. The Bible translators allowed the bias of their time in history to vary the meaning of the words of Paul. And because the Greek term that Paul uses to describe in 1 Corinthians when he talks about sex between men is really the term for pedophilia. Roman and Greek men abused young boys the way that many men then and still today abuse young girls. Sex between men was normal as sex between men and women in Paul's world and in Jesus' world. Neither of them, Paul nor Jesus, ever felt a need that we have recorded to be critical of gay sex. We got just because probably it was normatively accepted. Paul was clearly upset with young boys being abused. It is horrible when as adults we abuse children, and it is a horrible mistranslation of a Greek word in Paul's letter to the Romans that has led to Christians just since 1946 to believe that the Bible condemns homosexuality. It just doesn't do it. I think in this room, we have to always be asking the question, what does it mean to be a progressive person of faith? And it means a lot in so many areas. But amongst the most important realities of being part of a progressive movement is that we are required to stand up and to stand out regarding the truths that we know. Progressive Christianity needs a bit of evangelical fervor. Traditional evangelical thought has that fervor because they believe that more important than living like Jesus is getting others to believe in Jesus. They are firmly convinced that without Jesus in people's hearts, that they're going to go straight to hell in a handbasket made by the devil's minions at IU who teach underwater basket weaving. God bless them. But there are other ways to think about faith than that overused, simplistic model that uses shame and fear as its primary motivator. And shame and fear do not produce love, only more fear. I believe that Jesus would be so disappointed with those efforts. Also, I suspect Jesus would be disappointed with our lack of invitation to others to come and see that there are a plethora of ways for faithful and scientific ways to demonstrate how widely and wildly open and inviting true love for the world of people and creatures, even for the very earth itself, what it can look and be like. We are the ones that are responsible to be out there doing the inviting in. For such a time as this, I believe that God is calling us to be radical advocates of love and inclusion. Radical can be a bit off-putting, can it? But the origin of the word does not reflect that cultural stigma. Dictionary.com defines radical as, and I'm quoting, of or going to the root of origin, fundamental, end quote. In other words, to be radical is to go back to the basics. At First United, our roots are in the Bible and in our history and in our tradition. For such a time as this, God called Esther to save the Jews in a radical act of the day that could have easily resulted in her death. Esther trusted God and became a radical for her Jewish community at that time living in Iran. For such a time as this, our time, God called Moses to leave Egypt in a radical act of faith to walk through the desert to the promised land. Moses trusted God and became a radical to define the legacy of the chosen people of God. For such a time as this, Jesus trusted God and became radical for hospitality, for inclusion, for love. For such a time as this, John Smith trusted God and became a radical for soul liberty and religious liberty. For such a time as this, our American Baptist foreparent, Roger Williams, God called Roger Williams to expand faith in America and to radically advocate for the separation of church and state. Roger Williams trusted God and became a radical defender of religious freedom. For such a time as this, God called Dr. King Jr. to have a radical dream of racial equality in the deeply segregated South. Dr. King trusted God and became a radical advocate of racial harmony and social justice. For such a time as this, the novelist and critic Raymond Williams once said, and I quote, "To be truly radical is to make hope possible rather than despair convincing," end quote. As progressive people who advocate for the 100% inclusion of all people, including LGBTQ individuals, our call is to make hope possible by making our faith evangelical, which is truly welcoming and affirming. For such a time as this, God has called us, God is calling us to act radically in the name of loving our siblings of any gender identity or sexual orientation as God has loved us. To act radically, demanding a halt to taking immigrant children away from their parents and caging all of them. To act radically for God's sake. In all that we do is what God is begging us to step forward and be this morning. I invite you to go out and to be radical.